Hello, and welcome back to the all-new Micro-Size Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast where everyone's wearing space clothes. Or are we? I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
G'day, Cobber on me too.
And we're heading into a Doctor Who story filled with regional accents.
Well, filled with colonials.
It's the Sontaran Experiment. So this one was mine, and it's such an interesting Doctor Who story. It's Doctor Who's first story all entirely shot on location. It's not the first story entirely shot on video, because, of course, a robot had its exteriors done on outside broadcast, but it's the first story entirely shot on outside broadcast. It is the first story produced for this production block. It was actually produced after Robot, but before Ark in Space. This is essentially Ark in Space's location allocation. They were produced as one six-part story, essentially.
And so I think that that's pretty much all we have to say about the Sontaran Experiment.
Tune
in next week.
You are very, very cynical and not at all sardonic, Nathan.
And very welcome here.
You know, I think it's quite easy to overlook this little two-part.
It really is very easy.
What would you...
Hang on. This is part of the gestalt entity that is the wondrousness of season 12. Yeah. It works beautifully. It sits perfectly. Loved it as a boy. I remember walking home in winter, very cold winter in 1976 or 76 when this was first shown, and having this in my head. There's something about being on the Windy Moors, Tom in that beautiful chocolate greatcoat and playing around with his big globe mushrooms.
Yes.
On that, which, hello, how did they survive many thousand years sitting on a heath?
They're case-hardened dinosaurine, Richard.
And he does mention that they are slightly corroded. So, you know, there you go. You've got...
hilarious results.
Yeah, Liz Sladen stumbling around in her yellow Mac and her beanie.
This is proper post-colonial SF, and we don't get that much of it. And I'm not just talking about the regional accents. Mm. I'm actually talking about the whole philosophy, moral philosophy behind
so
it.
There's the idea that the people up on Nerva are kind of like privileged, posh people.
They are.
And we don't
properly... It's Elysium all it's over, Elysium. Isn't it?
But with slightly better usage of Jodie Foster, I think, in this case.
Well, by not having her in it.
Well, I just thought Jodie Foster didn't get enough to do in Elysium, whereas Wendy Williams gets a hell of a lot to do.
No, fair enough. So they're kind of posh, and we don't actually really strictly believe in them. And so all
we
that's
don't.
Left,
it's so long ago.
Yeah, all that's left are the people that Vira was calling, or Noah were calling, regressives.
Yes.
And there's some awful lines that are even cut out about the filthy colonials, the filthy lot.
Colonialism's a bit of a Bob Holmes trope, isn't it? I mean, the last...
Oh, have a drink, listen.
Yes.
Well, of course, the Sontarans themselves, very colonial.
Well, even we discover, you know, in Ark in Space, that the Wirren attack is the result of colonial... You know,
it is.
The human colonists colonise Andromeda
what
and destroy... They destroy the breeding grounds and kill the Wirren. And so that's why the Wirren come back. It's the result of colonialism. It's something that is present in a lot of Holmes's writing and sometimes to its detriment, as we'll discover.
Is it, though? It's a lovely to have a villain who's entirely vindicated to the point that, well, if I was in their situation, would I behave any differently? I don't know.
Would you eat someone's brain? Probably not.
Well, we've just had lunch. So
not until 3 or 4 o'clock, anyway.
So now in this story, we see the other side of it, don't we? We see the colonists, the Galsec colonists.
Does that stand for Galactic Security? I keep looking it up.
I thought it was a shiny fabric.
Oh, people spell like it GAL capital SEC.
Yeah, so it's Galactic Security or Galactic Sector, perhaps.
Okay, but they're all from South Africa.
Yes, they all have these South African accents. And, of course, the writer of the Space Museum, who was South African, Glyn Jones, is one of them.
I think that's spectacular. He's reasonably handsome, actually. He's a bit older than the others, maybe.
I believe he's Krantz,
Daddy Colin.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's Krantz.
He's Krantz.
But it doesn't show.
he looks quite well to me. It's just hard to imagine that this is the same show as the Space Museum, frankly.
Yes.
Like, I adore the Space Museum. I absolutely love it to death, even the bits that everyone else hates. This is just, you know, absolutely...
We're light years away.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that we're not in the studio, as Brendan mentioned, and that we are in this incredible, huge location.
Do you know what we are, though? We're in torture porn land.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is actually about cruelty. It starts off with an unforgiving, blighted landscape. Mm. You know, they wanted to actually have Lord Nelson popping up out of one of the crags, out of one of the hills, but they just didn't have the money for the model. But yeah, it would have been. It's very Planet of the Apes, isn't it? When you see the Statue of Liberty in the final scene, but, and that's where it would have come from. Yeah, I'm kind of glad they didn't do it.
We're influenced by another film here, just like we were influenced by Robot. Sorry, just like we were influenced by King Kong back with Robot. We have the influence of Planet of the Apes slightly here, although here it's not a twist that it's Earth. We know that it's Earth. On the topic of it being kind of torture porn, well, released just the year before was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which, of course, kick-started this whole really 15-year run of quite violent, sadistic, horrific torture-based films.
Mm.
So we see the Sontarans doing that in this story. And what's amazing is Ark in Space was so atmospheric because of its tight, claustrophobic sets. Even the vast chamber that all of humanity is stored in, it's tall, it's like a silo, rather than being expansive on the ground. So it still feels quite small and it can be shot quite small. This story manages to be atmospheric in wide open spaces. Because
we don't often get a horizon in Doctor Who. We get two full episodes of nothing but.
There's no buildings. And because there's no buildings, there's no authority to run to. There's no unit, there's no chaos. Brigadier. It's exactly. It's chaos.
And the threat is even more so because of that.
So this is a sort of Nazism thing. Don't you think? The experiments that the Sontaran is running.
Oh, yes, I take your point.
They're like Nazi scientists. Yeah, so he's Joseph Mengele. And so, you know, he's drowned someone. Like, he's tested someone's resistance to being immersed in fluids.
Yes.
I love his conclusion. I conclude that the human beings have very little resistance to being immersed in fluids.
Yes. Good on him.
They were all space boys. You know, he should have just tested out their resilience to being drunk. We would have really come out on top.
And so, like, you know, podcast. He's burned.
Yes, the burnt boy.
What's it, Roth? He's burned Roth.
Yeah, Roth is my favourite character.
Does he test Zake? He tests Zake's resistance to being pushed off a cliff.
No, he
Walsh
does.
Watch. It's Walsh Watch.
It's Walsh
Zake is an uncredited Terry Walsh.
Terry Walsh is the star of this.
Oh, no, he is credited.
Oh, is he?
He does receive an on-screen credit.
Terry gets a new wig in this.
He does. He doesn't receive an on...
We'll come to that later.
Yeah. He doesn't receive an on-set screen credit for his other major role, which we will get to. Mm. Yeah,
I would like to talk a bit more about the Galsec team. As Richard intimated earlier, they are all given South African accents, which was quite topical at the time. Of course,
the Springbok tours.
The Springbok tours. For almost 30 years, apartheid had been active in South Africa, but at this point, international pressure was very high, but also internal pressure was very high. The student and trade unions were both protesting and picketing in South Africa for the abolition of apartheid. So I think it's very interesting that either the writers, Bob Baker and Dave Martin, in possibly their most focused script to date, because it's so short, or possibly the director, Rodney Bennett.
Who's very good.
One of those three, or any combination, must have decided, we're going to make these colonists South African.
Now, how many of the actors are actually South African?
None of them.
Glyn Jones.
No, apparently they all put it on rehearsals, and that's good enough for the BBC.
And Glyn Jones sort of coached them on the accent.
Yeah. I think they're fine. Better than my terrible South African.
You can draw one of two conclusions from it. You can say either that the criticism of the apartheid regime at the time has had the effect of, at this point in the future, obviously we're very far in the future, but South Africa has obviously done well in order to form members of a space service entirely together. But at the same time, like up on the Ark, everyone's white.
Well, my theory is that it's the South African version of Starship UK from Beast Below. Because what's also happening at this time is of the solar flares is a lot of posh white people get into the Ark, and then a whole bunch of other English people get into Starship UK in order to evade
the solar flares. And of course, so Scotland have its own ship.
They would. And South Africa, presumably, is where Galsec gets its people from. So I think it's just you want them to be colonials, you want them to be from the Dominions, so the people from Earth speak with English accents, and the people from Earth colonies speak with accents that come from former British colonies. Surely that's the reason.
And they've also developed, and I mean, it's limited in the story, of course, because you can't have too much of it, but they had their own lexicon.
They were playing a lot with it. They tried it in Ark in Space, and Bob Holmes was very interested in the progression, the consonantal shift, isn't that a terrible expression, of language growth. There's a few lines, and if you watch the Ark in Space commentaries, you can see.
They have a very different vocabulary, don't they?
Yeah, they play around with all of that.
Yeah, whereas the language changes for the Galsec colonists, it's very much based on portmanteaus, running words together, so you understand, it becomes you understand.
I thought that was just Roth.
Oh, no, they all say it. Oh, okay. They all say it. Like when they're interrogating the Doctor, when Vorul is interrogating the Doctor, he says, you understand. The other one that really sticks in my mind is, and this relates to their, obviously, technological society, being from space colonies and travelling back to Earth, whenever they say yes, very often they don't say yes, they say check, yes. As you would do with a technical check. Yeah. So when they're trying to pick holes in the Doctor's story, saying, you said you came by transporter, check, check. Well, the transporter doesn't work, check, check. So therefore you're wrong, check, check. I can really see that that's Robert Holmes's influence, because linguistics hasn't been much of a focus for the show before, but we will see it going through the next 3 years.
Very much so when we get our next Doctor's Companion.
Yes, indeed.
But that's a spoiler alert, I believe, to use your expression.
I really love how bleak this is. It's the windswept landscape to how they look. They look so dirty. They just look like they've been there for weeks. Like,
they've all got beards.
They look like they've been at a dance party
like this
all weekend.
Apart from you, Todd.
Yes, quite.
But I think that's right.
And also that horrible little robot with its little...
You don't like the robot?
I don't know the robot.
No, that's not what I said.
Oh, okay. Oh, horrible. As in it's nasty. It really does sound like,
actually, as a child, and even watching it again now, I just am freaked out by it. The fact that it is quite flimsy, but it can actually rope them all up.
And insectoid and non-anthropomorphic. Yeah. Just in case you missed it.
It's got those lovely 70s decals
it
on
it. It does have gorgeous.
Thorax,
it's a bit Blake 7. Thorax again. It's a bit Blake 7, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, no, it's terrible.
Well, I really like it. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it is really good. I love the supporting cast in this.
And also, just before we go back to the supporting cast, the shape of that robot's head, that odd sort of double trapezoid shape, there is a library in South London that looks exactly like it.
Complete, as an homage.
Complete with the windows. Complete with the windows to emulate the eyes of the insectoid robot. I believe I have a photo somewhere on my computer. I will try and find it for the show notes.
Was this built after?
Oh, yes, long after. Yeah.
I have put...
I just thought Bob Baker and Dave Martin might have actually got inspiration.
No, no, it's probably the other way around. Architects do this. I can't... And luckily no clients listening to this. I have put homages to the roundels, the TARDIS circular walls, on most jobs. I got away with it a couple of times.
They're your fjords.
They are. And I've got the beard to prove it. Yeah.
But I was just freaked out by this as a kid. Yeah. And I think it's the torture of Sarah that really does me in.
What happens to torture for the listener?
So,
this one?
So with Sarah, sorry to Sarah, she gets scared by cliffs.
Resistance to fear. Fake snakes.
And, inflatable snake.
And... creeping mud.
Yeah, that's horrifying. And then Tom rips...
It's porridge, though.
Tom rips her thing off and she goes unconscious. It's really... Yes. But it's really brutal. Like, someone's dying of thirst. Later on, he's going to get them to not crush Vural's thorax.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it is awful. And the scene with Sarah is really, really frightening. And
it is.
She plays frightened so well.
And she does it so well. She actually heightens it.
Yeah. It's that old thing of, if you're going to bring a monster back, you have to up the threat. So before, we just had one Sontar, and here we only have one Sontar. We see his boss... the field major, field marshal.
Identical other than the busty substances on his collar.
Yeah, he does.
He's got enormous chalk-bit breastplates.
Well, yeah, I think he's like the whatever it is, the Grand Admiral whatever from the Seeds of Death, who is the same except for the sequins.
He really should be Cyril Shapps, shouldn't he? His other Archimandrite in space.
You know, I do wonder if that's how sort of marshals and generals are ranked in the Sontaran armed forces. You know, on Earth we have stars for generals. Maybe they have like a two-breasted general. I don't know.
I love the way in which Sarah, you know, thinks that he's absolutely identical.
Oh, he is. He's got the same number of fingers and everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hang on, though. This has been many, many thousands of years. There's nothing to say that the
She thinks it's less.
Well, look, maybe she's like Katie and doesn't wear glasses on.
There you go.
So it was that thing where Kevin Lindsay found the fiberglass mask too much.
Yeah, it would have killed him. Hard
to wear.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's replaced with
a rubber. There were lots of pauses during the shoot where they had to bring him his lunch in a little paper bag.
He couldn't go up and down the hill.
He couldn't.
With the combination of the mask, the suit, and his heart trouble.
And I heard.
Sadly, a year later, would claim his life.
They just had to put his sandwiches in a blender and feed it in through his probic vent, apparently.
That's right.
Do you know the most expensive thing in this entire production? The thing that costs more than anything else, including the location shoot?
I'm going to go.
The suit.
What?
The suit is made of mylar. Mylar is the stuff that was developed as a skin for satellites. It's silver plastic. It's terribly, terribly thin and fragile. Why did they use it to make Kevin Lindsay's suit? It meant that Terry Walsh had to be terribly delicate and careful with Stuart Fell, who was dressed up as Kevin Lindsay for the fight scenes because stuff tears. It does look pretty impressive, but it costs a bomb. Yeah.
So I actually think, again, you know, I've said about the tone of season 12 before, and I'm going to go on and on and on about it. The last time we saw the Sontarans, it was all wacky capers and high japes, and they were dressing up as friars and you know, throwing stink bombs into castles and stuff, and it was all jolly and really fun. But now we're just doing Nazi torture doctors, do you know what I mean? And I just kind of like, I like this story, I guess, although I'll deny it if you press me.
Good thing those comments aren't being recorded.
No, I never said anything, but I do worry about the tone, and it is another thing where I sort of think, why the hell would Sarah ever get back in the TARDIS again after this stuff happens?
But don't we feel that this is just a reflection of the current times in the so-called real world? You know what Britain was going through right now, a fuel crisis, to the point that, you know, they had the three-day week. People were having power cuts, which would have gone for several hours during each day. And the government had sanctioned, and it was much publicised, they were testing students who were getting paid to do the results at the time of going pretty much the same kinds of things, of subjecting them to cold, subjecting them to living without electricity, and all these other things. There was talk in the press of old people dying because freezing at home because of power cuts. Britain was going through the same level of ardour.
No, but Britain should say after the war. Do you know what I mean? Like, if Doctor Who's going to be sort of all about Nazi torturers, you know, whenever Britain's having a bad time politically, I mean, the last 12 years of Doctor Who would have been pretty rough, I think.
See, it's not about the torture, though. This is where I have to disagree with you, because Texas Chainsaw Massacre is about the torture, and the reason you know that is that Leatherface is still alive at the end. This is about the spirit of human endurance and the spirit of human compassion, because at the end, when he's doing the double test of human strength versus the strength of the ribcage...
Yeah, compressibility of
the... you know, Steyer sums up the theme of the story, which is, he is a traitor to your kind, why do you still fight to save him? And it's because he is still of their kind. And he has been working, you know, to try to buy them time. Yes, he's a collaborator.
I just thought they didn't want bits of lung all over their space clothing. Do you know what I mean? Like, if they dropped the thing, it would be messy and kind of unpleasant to look at.
But, well, this is the point. They're so against torture that they will fight to save someone they hate, as well as fighting to save themselves. Harry's first response when he finds that poor guy, whose character doesn't even get a name, dangling from the cliff face,
dehydration,
is to hydrate him. And of course, you know, he's a doctor, he heals the sick, but he doesn't attempt to find out what's going on and why he's there. His first response is to treat him. When Sarah first encounters Roth, who I agree with you, Richard, of the human guest characters, is the strongest one and the one we like the most. And when he's killed, it's very affecting. Again, because of Sarah's reaction. But her first reaction to him is she sees the burns on his arms. And you know what? Sarah, a year ago, probably would have run away from that situation, the same way that she's nervous around Alpha Centauri and nervous around Bilal.
Yes.
Compare that to how she reacts to the K-1 robot a few stories ago, where she immediately treats him like a sentient being when no one else will.
This story gets a bit smoochy, if we want to be honest.
Yeah, this story, it does contain torture, and it is harrowing and it is disturbing to see these images, but it is about that spirit of resilience. And perhaps there are better ways to explore that spirit of resilience, but I think maybe that's why Sarah sticks around, because even though she's put through these horrible situations, she can help others.
You see, I think that you're overselling the spirit of resilience thing, to be honest, because in 50 minutes of, like, this two-episode story, we get, like, basically one piece of evidence that that's the theme. Do you know what I mean? Harry would do that anyway. Our heroes are all good guys, so, you know, we expect them to behave morally. So you've got this one thing where the guys don't want to drop the big gravity bar on Vural's chest. I don't know that's enough to say that this is a great triumph of human blah, blah, blah over torture-y guys.
Well, they don't kill the Doctor the first second they find him. They try and find out information from him to find their missing crewmates.
They keep wanting to kill him, though, don't
they? They keep threatening to, but they don't. And then, when they do see their missing crewmate, they forget all about the Doctor. It becomes all about finding Roth and trying to save him and finding out what is going on. They're only so angry with the Doctor because they think they've killed their friend Zake.
Terry.
They think the Doctor's killed Terry. No, I think they're quite a tight-knit bunch. And in a way, they're more human than the people up on Nerva because of that camaraderie. We're presented two very different facets of humanity in two stories, and I believe it is deliberate.
What do you think?
Well, I think I've just learned something, dear listener, that I've never even thought of before in my entire life. I just want to be entertained from week to week and go along with the ride. But
is this entertaining, do you think, Todd?
Well, it's disturbing. And as a kid, I really found this really it hard is. To sit through. Even now, of all the stories in this season, I find it the hardest to sit through because of what's going on there.
I also think it is a bit disposable, do you know what I mean? Given that all of the guest characters are roughly interchangeable, do you know what I mean? It's just a bunch of white guys with beards wearing the same clothes as each other.
I guess so, and also, too, it comes out of the fact, too, that there was a six-part story which has now been split up into four parts and two parts, something that Bob Holmes is going to continually do with six-part stories from here on
in. Next story.
Yeah. Mm. They do have a line in there. They say, Nerva has never been found.
Hello.
And it's not that far. It jarred with me. I just went, like, it's a big friggin' space thing. And you've got here onto this planet somehow, surely, unless it was on the dark side of the planet when you orbit it.
Yeah, it's very. Still, it is a very strange line.
It's orbit. Not in orbit of Earth, is it? It is.
It is. Yeah, you've seen it. It is. Clearly, yeah.
They must move it around. It'll be in the orbit of Jupiter soon.
God, that's crazy. Imagine moving it that far.
Yeah, absurd.
But I guess a big thing in this episode, or this story, is the fact that, you know, Tom broke his collarbone.
So he's largely played by Terry Walsh in episode two, like more than ever before.
So, yeah, poor Tom. He films one story at the same time as John is filming his last story. So he gets a nice long holiday in between, turns up on location, I think 2 or 3 days on. He tries to clamber over a rock because he's like, I'm 40 and I'm playing this man of action and I'm Doctor Who and ow, I've just done something bad. Poor bugger.
I actually think the wig and all that is okay. It's the way Terry Walsh actually moves. He doesn't have the same body movements and so it just doesn't sell it in long shot.
I don't know how I never spotted it before because watching it this time, and I'm kind of primed for Terry. Like my Terry antennae are pretty good by this stage. And just every second shot is Terry Walsh. It's amazing.
I mean, as a kid, I never saw that.
No, me either. Yeah.
I think it really helps, just like it did in Planet of the Spiders, that the wig is so good. It's such a close match for Tom that it is really, really good. And there is the obligatory moment where, if Terry Walsh is playing a stunt double, you've got to have this obligatory moment where you see his face, which is the last time he tackles Steyr. Do have a look at towards the end of episode two, and they overdub it with a line of dialogue from Tom to try and sell it. And sort of Terry is holding his hands up in kind of in front of his face because he's about to grab Steyr from behind. As his arms sort of come down, you see that it's Terry Walsh sort of grunting with exertion.
Awesome.
So do keep an eye out for that. But I do think, though, in this whole situation, the person really worthy of praise is Tom, who is sitting there with a broken collarbone and neck brace under his giant overcoat, and it's just lucky that he happened to be wearing that for this story, and just getting on with his lines. The only difference is he's so still, whereas he's been so active earlier on. But that's okay. The Fourth Doctor stares off in the middle distance for his dialogue all the time. I think, good on you, Tom, for just getting on with it in what, in a modern production, would set everything back by a few weeks. Or they just put Trigger from Only Fools and Horses in a wheelchair.
You know what happened? You know what happened to Todd, though. Mr. Todd. You know what did happen to Todd? What that's not for this podcast. You know what happened to? We'll have to cut that out as well. You know what happened to Tom when he broke his collarbone? It was Roger Murray Leach who drove him. It's the most isolated bit of England you can get to. It's 80 miles drive to town, and Tom was slashed up, so to speak, in the scarf. They used the scarf as a tourniquet bound him up. And all the way back, Roger Murray Leach was saying Tom was utterly white-faced terrified that they would cut him. It hadn't gone out yet. Yeah, Tom hadn't been seen. Yeah. He thought, that's it, they're just going to replace me. Yeah. So he's really, this is the anti-Tom. He's really well-behaved on set and charming at everybody.
Once he's sure of himself, though, nothing can stop him short of a blow to the probic vent.
You can see the lovely thorax, though it is. You can see the ontological threat, have another drink, that Tom is to become in this, though, can't you? Just as in you can in Ark in Space. And yes, in Robot, he's so powerful. He's so jolly. He's just such an enormous man. He's an enormous mind, enormous humour, huge personality, that ego. You can see the monster that is about to come in the Williams era. But this is why I really like him in this. He's still got the lid on him. And Hinchcliffe, he has so much respect for Hinchcliffe and gratitude both ways. But also Hinchcliffe has a mighty, powerful, quiet presence, and he's exactly the Tupperware lid needed to keep Tom down. And Ian and Liz, he's not going to misbehave with those two.
I just can't believe that I never spotted it as a kid, the injury, and how still he is in that second episode. You can see it now that we're looking for it. I'm also wondering, like, you know, Ian Martyr throws himself down that ravine or whatever it is.
Does it?
With some force. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't injure himself with that particular fall.
Yeah, I mean, it does look like him, doesn't it?
It does.
It's him, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. And I've tried to look it up, and all the usual sources doesn't mention
back,
it one way or
the other.
You
have to go back to the Ark in Space with those bottoms that follow you around the room. That's how you know it's real art, listener,
did
the bottoms follow you. When they're under the desk.
Could I say Ian Levine, or did I say Ian Martyr? I can't remember.
Is it the same bottom that goes down the ravine?
Oh, we are getting behind ourselves now.
I love the fact that Harry has to go and save the day. He knows exactly how to use the sonic screwdriver, having never seen it before.
No. It's quite wonderful because the Doctor gives him some instruction, and when he's holding out the sonic screwdriver, he holds it out as far as he can and then turns his face away and winces. Yeah. It's like very nervously opening a bottle of very fizzy champagne. Oh, God, Ian Martyr's wonderful.
I love the moment when Steyr
Deflates.
Yeah. I remember that as a kid.
It's great, isn't it? And then, of course, we've still got the massive invasion fleet that we've just talked about, and we've very cheaply realised by just having Kevin Lindsay on a sort of 60s space television in the rocks
talking
about
it. And in a wibbly, wobbly, timey-wimey way, they suddenly become Vogons from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because they can't invade the planet without the full report.
The forms that he's filled in. Yeah, that's right.
It's a good ending, but it's a very strange ending.
No, it's not a good ending. And he goes, next time I will destroy you, and that's it. And he even sort of switches the thing off, and that's that whole invasion gone.
It's your Waterloo, Marshal.
Now we get a comic ending with the transmats popping in and out, just like we had at the beginning of the story. Such humour.
Yeah,
thanks, Bob Baker and Dave Martin.
Except you don't end up with Liz Sladen A over T, do you?
When this was first released, it came out as a double pack with Genesis of the
Daleks.
That
is correct.
Yeah, on VHS.
Did it also come out that way on DVD?
No, it came out individually. It was the first two-part story to be released on DVD.
And it was cheaper price with that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was this interesting thing of they first announced that it was going to be a cheaper price with fewer special features, but then when they released it, they also paired it up with the other existing Sontaran stories and put them in a box set, which meant there was a budget for a documentary.
Yeah.
And the whole thinking it too entertaining at the time was that, oh, if we have a budget range of titles, we can put more money into the special features on the full price range of titles, until they looked at the pre-sales figures, and they discovered that the price they charged the DVDs at had no bearing on the pre-sales. They were expecting more pre-sales for the cheaper ones, and less pre-sales otherwise, so they just put everything back up to the same price.
Oh. Less. Thanks, Beeb. Is it okay to say that this podcast is actually as long as watching the Sundarin experiment? You might as well just turn the sound down.
We could keep, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, if we go on any longer, dear listener, I'm afraid that one of us will break a collarbone. So that's all the time we have for this episode. We will be back next week talking about one of the amazing classics of Doctor Who. Or is it Genesis of the Daleks?
It's terrible.
You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, which has a revolutionary review system, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night. See you soon.
Happy Terry Walshing.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Chock Bit Breastplates, was recorded on Sunday, June 14th. The next episode will be released on the 12th of July. If that was the Sontarans' Waterloo, I can't wait to hear their Mamma Mia.
Okay, I'm just going to check something because I do.
Where we stand. And George Powell was there. In silver underwear, Claude Rains was the invisible man. I haven't seen that since I was 18.
Really? It's incoherent.
Do you know my friend Alexandra, her Aunt Rose, was the original Janet in the Australian production.
Really? Yes. Oh,
she has some great stories. I don't know if she's still alive, actually. Rose was fabulous. Hello, darling. And Clint.
Is that the name of this episode?
Oh no. Hello,
that's the cutaway.
Flight Through Entirety.
That's the cutaway line.
That's great, you should do that.
Please do that.
Hello and welcome to Flight Through Entirety.
G'day, Cobber. We're all doing regional today. We're all doing colonial.